Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:57 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is January 21st. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought we'd kick off with the NASDAQ because it has had a significant inconsistency. So let's just count them down. We've certainly had a consistent trend up over the course of the last almost 2 years. And we've had a sequence of ranges, one above another. So that's no longer true. So that's the first inconsistency. Now, it could have still been a consistent trend up until last week, because it was still holding in the region of the upper side of the underlying range. But it's also worth highlighting that this was a downside weekly key reversal that was downside follow through. So that was a warning shot. The downward dynamic we had and into the follow-through last week was another warning shot, and this is a break of trend, and we're below the 200-day moving average for the first time since February-March of 2020. So this isn't the first time this has happened. But we also have to bear in mind that the other times when we've had the NASDAQ pulling back below the 200-day moving average, they have coincided with either the end of a quantitative easing program, and that was certainly the case in 2018 as well, or the pandemic, and which of course was a massive liquidity event, although it was a very, very short duration event. And now we're looking at financial conditions tightening from extraordinarily easy levels. And it hasn't really happened yet. But the bond market hasn't really lost any time in pricing in the potential, at least, that the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates significantly this year. I mean, you even have Jamie Dimon talking about the Fed raising anywhere from 6 to 7 times this year. And that is just completely beyond the pale in terms of forecasts. Well, we're going to have Jay Powell speaking on Wednesday. And the market is going to be looking for him to make some kind of placating remark. And the market has also been pricing in the scope that they're going to raise rates by 50 basis points in March. And the stock market now is down. The NASDAQ is down about 13%. So we're already into a good-sized pullback. And now it's time to start thinking about how far could this pull back. Well, the one thing that's been holding the market up, despite the fact that, well, let's just look at the things that have been pulling back most violently. The IPO index, or the ETF, has been pulling back most violently. And it peaked almost a year ago, then found support more or less in the region of the trend mean, and then started another leg down over the course of the last 2 months, and it was down again in here today. So it's now rapidly unwinding the big advance we saw during the pandemic. Cathie Wood, who was the champion of investing in innovative companies, saw her fund peak in January of last year as well. And it's also been breaking down, and it was down significantly again in here today. The SPAC index in the USA is continuing to trend lower. So this is certainly weighing, this move we've had in bond yields is weighing on these highly speculative instruments. But the large caps were the ones that really helped the market to sustain its outperformance until just this week. But now the eight largest companies, which are Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, and then Microsoft, Amazon, Nvidia, and Tesla, they outperformed from 2013 and then again in a really dynamic manner in 2020, lost momentum for most of 2021, failed to sustain the upward break at the end of last year, and now it's back below the 200-day moving average. And then we can think about Netflix, which was down something in the order of 23% in here today. So it's now rapidly unwinding the advance we saw during the pandemic. And I'm not going to rant any longer about my dislike of the way that they write their programs, but the reality is that it's a very repetitive in nature and that eventually people just get sick of it. And now the price is back in the region of the upper side of that underlying range, which proceeded from 2018 through to 2020. So if it's going to find support, this is the area. But the challenge is that with declining subscriber numbers and an inability to grow, it's got negative free cash flow. They've got 6 billion in cash and they're spending 15 billion a year on new programming. And there was a statistic this year or this week that Netflix's budget for new programming exceeds the entire programming budget for the five largest state-owned broadcasters in Europe. And again, that's just another example of these extraordinary comparisons that we've had over the course of the last few years. And one thing that it has definitely helped to highlight is just how egregious some of the valuations have become and then remained so. So we had the contention, but it wasn't a contention, it was a fact. Back in August of 2020, that the five largest of those FANG companies were worth more than the entire market cap of Europe, which is really an extraordinary circumstance. And of course, it helped to highlight the value proposition. So, right after that, or just a couple of months after that, Europe broke on the upside and then was at a new all-time high within about 6 months. So, it's quite likely now that we're going to see an unwinding of the overbought condition. But Europe trades on a much more attractive valuation than Wall Street, and it's only just beginning to break out. And Wall Street broke out in 2013, so it's been rallying for 8 years already. So it's got a lot more room to unwind some valuations. Then, of course, there was in December of 2020, there was again, fact that Tesla was worth more than the entire market cap of the majority of the other major automotive companies. And it wasn't long afterwards that Ford popped on the upside, broke what was a 6-year downtrend, and then rallied in a really significant manner. But it is coming down heavy in here this week. So this is all, and of course, it's also been a really benign environment over the course of the last couple of years for the car companies because they haven't been manufacturing as many. They've found that there's lots of demand. They've been able to improve their margins despite the fact they're producing fewer vehicles. So that's all contributed to this enthusiasm. And now we're starting to see some of the impact of higher interest rates on the ability of consumers to pay for vehicles. And I mean, it's quite common, particularly around where I live, to see people with 7-year car loans. And a 7-year vehicle, particularly if it's got anywhere in the region of 100,000 miles, isn't worth a fraction of what one ends up having to have paid for it. Then, of course, we have the fact that Dogecoin is worth more than all of the futures traded in silver. And silver prices rebounded quite impressively this week. But what all of these comparisons help to highlight is the value growth argument. So, growth has done spectacularly well over the course of the last decade. And some of the companies and some of the instruments have done incredibly well. And now the big question is how can they perform in a rising interest rate environment? So we're in this corrective phase, and it's helping to throw the focus of attention back onto physical assets. So Silver is bouncing from the lower side of its range, and this continues to look like a well-defined first step above the base. And if we look at more back history, well, we're still at a fraction of the peak value from back in 2011. It could double from here and it would still be just below the peak from 2011, but this looks like a first step above the base. And it looks quite similar to that initial ramping up of interest in silver from back in 2004. And it gave up the majority of the advance and then found support in the region of the upper side of the base formation. And then continued to be really very volatile for years to come afterwards, but then continued to put in these lengthy ranges and big breakouts and lengthy ranges and big breakouts. And I suspect that that's exactly what we're seeing again here, that we've had a lengthy consolidation for silver and gold, and it's going to be resolved on the upside. And precious metals tend to do best when central banks can't do what they need to, and central banks, particularly in the developed world, are inhibited from raising rates to the extent that they need to completely dispel the fear of inflation. So, what's likely, at least, is that I think at least the Federal Reserve is not going to raise rates by 50 basis points, and that right off the bat. That instead they're going to say that things are going to remain steady and predictable, and that they're going to assess the situation, and that they think that inflationary pressures are going to moderate. And bond yields are beginning to ease. And if we see downside follow through next week, this is going to be a failed upside break. And that could take the yield back down into the 1.25% level. So, that's certainly something that we need to pay attention to, because we've had a lot of risk assets pulling back in a really quite aggressive manner this week, and Bitcoin is down below the 40,000 level in here today. And after the turn at 4 o'clock, now it is starting to steady ever so slightly in weekend trading. But there's a rivetingly consistent sequence of lower rally highs that's been evident since November. So it's at least going to have to take out the 44,000 level in or 44,800 level to begin to demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment beyond the scope for short-term steadying. And Ethereum has also broken down below the 3,000 level in here today. So this is a significant inconsistency, and particularly when we see inconsistencies coming through in cryptocurrencies, well, it's an even bigger indication of a loss or a big change in terms of the interaction between supply and demand, because there aren't any real fundamentals, and it's a completely liquidity dependent, momentum driven market. And liquidity is at least not growing at nearly the same extent that it was in the past. So the total assets of central banks, they are continuing to rise, but not nearly at the same rate of increase. And I think that it's what we're seeing right now is people worrying about inflation. And obviously the big uptick in inflationary pressures has become multifaceted. Some of the things that people are worried about are going to be dispelled by asset prices starting to come back down. And we're starting to see that some of the supply chain worries are easing. I'm not all that certain what exactly is going on with the Baltic Dry Index, because it's coming back with a bang and it's pulled back into the base formation. And it was down again in here today, and I don't exactly know why. So we can think about some of the shipping companies, and they were weaker just like everything else this week, but they're not pulling back in to the same extent as the Baltic Dry Index. And if we think about the tanker companies, well, oil prices put in a downside key reversal yesterday and followed through a bit on the downside in here today, and those tanker rates haven't been nearly as volatile as the dry bulk shipping companies. And the price of shipping goods to and from China is still close to the highs. So this might be more to do with coal prices and the shortage of coal, and the less coal that's being produced, resulting in fewer of the dry bulk shipping demand in the short term. And that's a very narrow part of the market. There are still a record number of ships waiting off the coast of Los Angeles to dock. So there's definitely a mismatch going on between this significant decline we've seen in the Baltic Dry Index and what's going on in the wider world. I'll have to do more research into this particular puzzle to try and figure out exactly what's going on. But as we move forward and as some asset prices begin to moderate, well, then inflationary pressures will start to come back down. And now we're starting to see semiconductor companies competing with one another to spend money on new production. Now, it might take a while to build those factories. And Taiwan Semiconductor popped on the upside when they announced that they're going to be building chips for Intel, and now the price is coming back down. Nvidia, which has been one of the best performing shares in the world over the course of the last few years, has pulled back in a violent manner, going from 350 to 230, and it was down again in a reasonably dynamic manner this week. So it's rapidly now unwinding its overbought condition relative to the trend mean. And at a minimum, this suggests that we're going to be moving into a more volatile period. Now, the big question is what's going to happen in terms of corporate profits? And corporate profits are going to be updated in the next couple of weeks for the last quarter. Now, they are often late in updating this chart, but it's certainly worth highlighting that one of the reasons why stocks were so strong is because corporate profits were at record highs up to September. And right now we're seeing some mixed results coming through from the current earnings season. So we had some of the banks saying that they're spending a lot more money on retaining their workforce. And Goldman pulled back in a violent manner this week. But one of the most important things is the commonality that we're seeing. We've seen the Nasdaq have almost this same pattern. Now we're seeing banks having this same pattern, where we get the big run-up, we get a loss of momentum, we get failed upside breaks, and now we're getting massive reactions against the prevailing trend. So these are type 2 top formations. And the massive reaction against the prevailing trend is the confirming signal to suggest that this is a completing top formation. Now, the question, of course, is whether this is a short, medium, or long-term top. Now, I'd be a lot more worried if high yield spreads were ramping higher, but they're not. High yield spreads are still really well contained, and despite the fact that we've had a great deal of volatility on Wall Street, and high yield shares, or the high yield bonds, excuse me, are weaker, but they're not going down in a dynamic manner. The vast majority of companies who wanted to refinance did so in 2020 and 2021. So we don't have the same maturity wall that was present in 2019, 2020. All those companies that were expected to have great difficulty refinancing, and there was a lot of talk about fallen angels and the potential for fallen angels in 2019 because of the risk of the maturity wall in 2020 and 2021. Well, that risk has been forestalled because all those companies refinanced. So we're not going to be looking at another big maturity wall for at least another 2 or 3 years. And to me, at least, that suggests that what we're looking at now is a medium-term correction. And then we can think about the yield curve. Now, the yield curve is contracting, and it's down to 75 basis points. And it was weaker, or it was tighter, I should say, in here today. And not least because the 10-year yield is falling faster than the 2-year. And we're still 75 basis points to the good, and we're not in an inverted condition. Now, we had an inverted condition last in 2019, and that did start the counter on the next recession. And I suspect that at some point this year we might, in fact, get an inverted yield curve, and that'll start the clock on the next recession, but it's not there yet. So there's certainly the potential here that we're going to see a pullback in the order of 20%. And the reason that I think the 20% level is important to pay attention to is that's exactly how much the market had to pull back in 2018 before the Federal Reserve would change their minds. So the market pulled back by 20.2%, and Steve Mnuchin convened the Plunge Protection Team on the 26th of December 2018, and basically passed the hat around and said, "Okay, what are we going to have to do to support this market?" And then the Federal Reserve stopped raising rates in early 2019. So the last interest rate hike was right before Christmas in 2018, and by the time we got around to July of 2019, they were already cutting rates. So it was a 20% pullback was enough for the Federal Reserve to start really changing tack. And we're not all that far away from it right now. Now, there's the potential here that we might have to pull back by more on this occasion because the market has gone up an awful lot in the last 2 years. So we're down about 8% right now. Now, that would suggest that we should also then be looking at the 1,000-day moving average. And the 1,000-day moving average is important from a secular perspective because in secular bull markets, and let's put in lots of back history here and go back all the way into the 1970s and 80s. In secular bull markets, the 1,000-day moving average acts as support. And in secular bear markets, where the market generally moves sideways in a volatile manner, it's really not useful. But then in secular bull markets, it starts to offer support again. So if this is still a secular bull market and we are in a medium-term correction, it's reasonable to anticipate that in the event that we do move into a much deeper pullback and that a lot of the really speculative activity that took place in 2020 and 2021 is unwound, it's reasonable to anticipate that the peak from early 2020 will hold. But that represents a pullback of another 900 points. And if that's the case, well, then what we would in fact be potentially looking at as a worst case scenario would be a pullback in the order of 30%. Now, obviously, that's a very deep pullback in terms of the potential in the stock market. And there is absolutely no way the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates into that kind of environment. So it does beg the question, where are rates going to go from here? Because if the stock market pulls back by 30%, it is going to cut. It's going to, I guess, probably a better way of describing it is it's going to lop off a really significant proportion of wealth for the economy. And household wealth and savings will deteriorate. So that'll be an immediate effect from the Federal Reserve perspective. They're going to be looking at households experiencing a diminishing wealth effect, and that's going to cut into spending. And if that's the case, you get slower growth. And they can't raise rates in a slow growth environment. So I think as the stock market pulls back and as we start to see some risk getting taken off, then there's the real potential that we might not see interest rate hikes at all. Or if we do, it's only going to be one or two. And I've been thinking about this for a while, and I really think that it might be a case of one and done. But the prospect of interest rates rising by four times or five times or six times this year is absolutely fanciful. If that were to occur, the stock market would be down more than 30%. And I just don't believe that we have an argument to support it. If semiconductor supply increases, there will be more cars produced. Excuse me, I just need to cough. And if there's more cars produced, secondhand car value will deteriorate, and that will reduce some of the inflationary pressures. Oil prices are still reasonably steady around the $90 area. They're still overbought in the short term. So there's the potential that we're going to see oil prices beginning to ease back again. Then lumber prices were limit down 3 days this week. So that's going to help to reduce some of the pressure on, or the upward pressure that's coming to bear on building of new homes. Ultimately, if growth moderates, demand will moderate. And the supply problems that the market has had is really all about less demand and more, or excuse me, it's about more demand and less about the ability of companies to increase supply. Now, of course, companies are definitely going to be increasing supply and doing everything they can. So then the bigger question is about really whether companies are going to see the same kind of demand coming through from all these different economies. And if growth moderates, well, then that's going to obviously impact inflationary pressures. So as we look at the total market and we start to think about the impact of some of the leverage getting taken out of this market, well, obviously that's going to have an impact. And then when we think about that, are we in a situation for Wall Street now that Europe encountered in 2012 and Japan encountered previously? Are we in a situation where the Federal Reserve is going to have extraordinary difficulty raising rates? And obviously, one thing that has helped the Federal Reserve and investors be confident that they can raise rates is that tax receipts in various states have ballooned during 2020 and 21 because of consumption. And we're back in almost full employment. So the coffers of states in particular are doing particularly well. But a lot of that has to do with asset prices and the bounce back from the really depressed environment that we had in 2020. And it's created inflationary fears and competition and precautionary spending and anticipatory spending. But a lot of that has been predicated on rising prices. So if the stock market continues to correct, well, then inflationary expectations are also going to moderate. And that's equally true for Bitcoin. And the 1,000-day moving average is equally important for Bitcoin as it is for the wider stock market, because Bitcoin's found support in the region of that 200-day moving average on successive occasions. And right now, it's the 20,000 level coincides with the 1,000-day moving average. And that's obviously something that is going to be tested over the coming weeks. If Bitcoin can't push back above 40,000 and break its downtrend over the last 6 weeks soon, well, then it's going to be taking out the lows from the middle of 2021, and we could be looking at another one of these Bitcoin winters. So we're definitely at a rather difficult environment here for the cryptocurrency sector generally. And of course, we've also had these just extraordinary moves in terms of the NFT market and grainy JPEGs being sold for millions of dollars. So when we think about what do we need here? We need very clear messaging from central banks that they're not going to be aggressive. They're not wedded to their view that liquidity needs to be withdrawn immediately. And that would help to reinstill confidence. But at the same time, they don't want to have a bubble either. So they also need to support growth. They also need to be very balanced in how they create their messaging. And in the meantime, we have type 2 top formations. So let's just think about what does a type 2 top formation generally look like? Amazon's another good example of that. So we have the lengthening range. We have failed upside breaks. We have the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. Well, some of the best examples of type 2 top formations come from 2008. And we can look at really any one of those European indices. So they trended higher in a really consistent and persistent manner from 2003 until 2007. Then went into a lengthier period of consolidation, broke downwards, and then ranged for a while and encountered resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average, which was already then moving downwards, and then broke downwards again. So we've seen exactly that that same kind of activity in the IPO ETF, where you have the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, this time following an acceleration, a lengthy period of right-hand extension, and then an additional decline. So we have a significant number of assets that have just begun to break downwards. And now there's the potential that these short-term oversold conditions might begin to rally next week when the Federal Reserve probably does make some calming statements. But the 200-day moving average is already moving lower on the IPO index. So it might bounce, but then it might start encountering resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. The problem with a lot of these arguments for innovation is that what they've done is they've compounded promises. But 3D printing isn't something that's easily scalable, and it surged higher in 2021, but only on enthusiasm and not about any concrete reason why 3D printing was suddenly going to become super profitable, and now the money is starting to flow back out of it. Companies like GameStop, which has singularly failed to embrace the online world, surged in value in 2021, and now it is unwinding some of that as people just express less interest in these meme stocks. And AMC Entertainment is also unwinding most of that advance put in 2021. So we're starting to return to reality for some of these types of companies. And now the bigger question is this the end of US exceptionalism and or Wall Street exceptionalism? Because obviously there are companies like Amazon that are pulling back, but Apple is really only unwinding its overbought condition relative to the trend mean. Microsoft was able to drop at $69 billion this week on Activision Blizzard, and that has really only resulted in the mar and in the share coming back to the region of the 200-day moving average. But these companies aren't going to hold up indefinitely if we continue to see downward pressure on the smaller companies. So Google is beginning to break downwards. Now, the one thing that I think is particularly relevant, and it's not something that I think most people pay attention to, it's that the cloud computing sector has done spectacularly well. And we have the certainly the innovation in terms of availability of off-site databases that allows people to work independently and outside the office, and with the introduction of 5G will allow for remote control of more different applications. But we also have a bit of a Y2K phenomenon in that a lot of the growth from the next few years has taken place already. And where's the growth going to come from to compete with the kind of boost that these companies had in 2020 and 2021? So they're necessarily going to have slower growth. So the cloud computing sector is breaking downwards now. But the problem for companies like Amazon, Google, and Microsoft is that they're the database holders. So they sell rack space to all of the small companies. And one of the reasons why we have so many small companies that have been able to crop up is because they don't have to build their own infrastructure in-house any longer. They simply buy rack space at the big data companies. But if these IPOs companies are starting to go under and the SPAC companies are doing badly, well, then there isn't going to be quite the same demand for rack space. And it's companies like Amazon and Google and Microsoft have been building database or data centers all over the world to cater to endless demand growth. So that's obviously a challenge for those businesses, and it could take a lump out of their valuation if growth stops in that sector as well. And one of the worst performers recently has been Datadog. And it's another one of those cloud computing companies. So this is obviously a challenge here, that the price is down from 200 to 125 in the space of about 10 weeks. And it's now coming back, another share that's coming back into the region of the upper side of the range. And against this background, there's really nothing that's going to continue to trend higher in a very consistent manner. Even the dividend aristocrats have experienced some pause and consolidation in here. But the reality right now is that cash flows matter, and reliable business models that are tested in a recession matter. And certainly that bolsters the appeal of companies that are dividend aristocrats. So they're likely to fall less. Now, we can also then think about the energy sector, because oil prices are there overbought in the short term, and it's likely that these overbought conditions on some of the big oil companies are also going to be unwound. But these are physical assets that are absolutely integral to the global economy regardless of what happens. And obviously that holds some appeal right now. And when we think about some of the better performers over the last week, well, it's some of those that have been that have pulled back most. So Kraft Heinz is also beginning to bounce in here. Sorry, my keyboard isn't keeping up with me. So it's bounced over the course of the last 6 weeks and testing again the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, as we look ahead, if Wall Street's exceptionalism is ending, well, then that's going to create demand for something else, and it's going to bolster the appeal of other asset classes. So we've already seen that Europe has broken on the upside, and India is obviously not going to be immune from selling pressure, and it was down in a dynamic manner this week. So it's increasingly likely that it could pull back more. But emerging market currencies have been quite steady. The Indian rupee really hasn't gone anywhere for nearly 2 years. The Brazilian real has in fact been steadying. They've raised rates 725 basis points in less than a year. So that's certainly helping to support the currency. Obviously, we have geopolitical considerations as well. And the Russian ruble is weakening again. And there's a lot of speculation about whether Russia is going to invade, or I guess push further into Ukraine. And obviously that's putting downward pressure on the currency. But Russia has about $700 billion in foreign currency, and they've been stocking up on gold. And they probably have concluded correctly that there's no appetite for a ground war between Russia and NATO in Ukraine, and that the worst that they'll do is arm, or that NATO will do is arm Ukrainian forces. But there's the real potential that the Ukraine army can't win against Russia, and that they're going to take over the Ukraine. It's a potential outcome. I suspect that Russia will be slow to do anything until they're finished with the policy that they've engaged in Kazakhstan. They're unlikely to want to fight on two fronts. But nonetheless, there's certainly some risk here that there's going to be intense geopolitical stress between Russia and NATO. And obviously, then that will also take a toll on stock prices. But ultimately, I think we're not looking at higher interest rates, where it's much more likely that if we're in a corrective phase, that interest rate hikes will be delayed. And that means that we're being set up for a buying opportunity. And that when we get the kind of calming measures that are necessary to arrest this decline, well, then there's going to be some attractive valuations. And that's going to, I think, feed through then into demand for the assets that hold relative strength. So copper prices remain really quite firm. And nickel continues to benefit from the cutback in carbon emissions in China, and it was up in a dynamic manner this week. So it's important to highlight the kinds of things that are doing well when the broader markets are pulling back in a rather violent manner. And copper is the secular bull market, or I guess the big secular bull market candidate, but cotton has broken out of a little first step above its base formation. And that's being driven by these concerns about excising Xinjiang cotton from the global market. The one thing, though, that I think is particularly relevant is if we look at exceptionally long-term data for most commodities, we see these exceptionally long ranges. And now we're seeing prices breaking up and out of those ranges. So there's obviously something different going on here. And I don't think it's alarmist to think about it in terms of global warming, because I think we need to pay attention to what farmers are saying. I've seen more than a few interviews with French vineyard owners, and certainly those that are producing champagne are migrating their vineyards north because the Champagne region is becoming too hot, and that Bordeaux wine producers are changing grape varieties to hardier varieties that can thrive in a hotter, drier environment. So that's just in France, which is a comparatively small geographical area. But we also saw that there was a significant frost in Brazil this year, and now we're seeing a drought. And the drought has certainly contributed to soybean prices being quite firm. But one thing that I think is rather relevant is that coffee, Arabica coffee prices have been ranging between 50 and 300 for 50 years. And one of the biggest sources of Arabica coffee is Brazil. And they get to grow their coffee on flat ground, whereas most other places it's on the sides of mountains. But if São Paulo becomes more subject to frost, then that's going to knock out a significant proportion of the growing capacity for Arabica. Now, obviously, it's going to create other areas where it will be able to be grown, and there'll be a period of transition. But is there the possibility then that if we do get more climate volatility and changing weather patterns, that some of these commodity prices that have been going sideways for what feels like a profound amount of time will then break higher? Because there is a comparison here between what's happening now and what happened in the 1960s, which, and it was the activity in the 1960s that contributed to the inflation of the 1970s. There was the anchovy collapse, and then that had knock-on effects for significant portions of the agricultural sector because of fish meal production, which then contributed to fertilizer prices rising. And fertilizer prices are rising quickly. Now, share prices in the sector haven't been doing quite as well, and Mosaic was down in a rather dynamic manner in here this week. But ultimately, we are still in an environment where the global population is going to rise by another couple of billion over the next 20 years. So that means we need to have a lot more food. So we're in a rising demand environment for all manner of food items. And we have the potential that there's going to be more climate volatility. And if that's the case, then that's going to contribute to higher prices and certainly to more demand for anything that can increase yields. So that's obviously something that will probably begin to attract the attention of investors. I did see a rather interesting graphic in here today about the dry powder in the private equity sector. So dry powder is up to almost 3.5 trillion, and we've had really significant advances in private equity. So now just private equity alone has in excess of 1 trillion. Venture capital is certainly significant as well at 444 billion. Real estate, private real assets, and of course, real assets we might describe as commodities. We might also think about it as property, but it's at 725 billion. So this is an additional reason for thinking that what we're looking at right now is a medium-term correction. And there's the real potential that a large number of companies that get beaten up by the market could get taken private, or we're going to see further investments in private assets. Of course, if we see more companies getting taken private and we continue to see companies buying back shares, well, that's going to reduce supply as well. So, and of course, if IPOs aren't doing quite as well and we don't see quite as many exits, well, that's also going to reduce supply. So I think that it's quite likely that what we're looking at now is a medium-term correction, and it's not a major, major market top like we saw in 2008. But we could be in for a lengthy period of underperformance on Wall Street, because if it pulls back by 20% or even 30%, then it could be a year, or it might even be 2 years before we get back up to the high. And in that time, there is ample potential for other assets to outperform. And we're just beginning to see that China is starting to ease up on its property sector. And they engineered a significant correction in property developers and property prices. And the Chinex index has not been immune from the selling pressure we've seen internationally. But if we do see China beginning to lighten up and inject additional liquidity, lower interest rates, well, then that should act as a support for its domestic technology sector. Now, companies like Alibaba have not been immune, and it was down in here today in a dynamic manner. So we might yet even see another leg downwards from here. But it's already half of where it was, and in fact, it's quite quite a bit lower than half of where it was at the end of 2020. So a lot of bad news has already been priced in. And the last thing that China wants is a rout. So the Shanghai Property Index isn't nearly as weak as other portions of the market. And a good part of the reason for that is that there's no leverage here. There was nobody who still has big, long leveraged positions in the Shanghai Stock Exchange. But one thing we certainly have is this underperformance in risk parity. I'll put this chart up on just to make it bigger. But risk parity has been an incredibly popular strategy over the course of the last decade, and it does best when the volatility on one asset relative to another falls, and it does worst when volatility on both stocks and bonds increases together. So that certainly happened in 2020. It also happened in 2015-16. So it underperforms during medium-term corrections, and it's now right back in the region of the 200-day moving average. So if bonds start to catch a bid, and I think it's likely that as inflationary pressures begin to moderate and growth concerns begin to appear, then bonds will become more attractive. And I think that it is quite likely that the USA is going to have a hard time raising rates, and not least because of the political reluctance to deal with the deficit issue and to deal with unfunded liabilities. And the cost of servicing the debt has risen significantly over the last 12 months, and there is no appetite for increasing taxes without increasing spending, which is, of course, what would be needed in order to deal with some of these challenges. So we might be looking at the Japanization of Europe, and perhaps now the Europeanization of North America. And if that's the case, and we see that interest rates can't rise, well, then investors will start to look at where they can achieve a yield. And the answer is going to be in the emerging markets. And if we continue to see that commodities do well, and countries remain dedicated to the energy transition, and I think that it's the carbon emissions market is going to start to attract investors because of bond-like guarantee characteristics and then equity-like returns. And this is a completely politically motivated market, and it's the way that that governments have figured out how to increase taxes. They know that there's a lot of resistance to increasing payroll taxes or sales taxes. So they invent a new form of tax, which is carbon emissions. So this is creating a market for first for raising capital from the kinds of companies that can't deal with the challenge of curtailing carbon emissions, and then also sponsoring the innovation of companies that offer solutions. And the mining sector sees itself as being a significant beneficiary of this transition, because in order to achieve those renewable energy goals, well, there's going to have to be a lot more mining. And when we hear, for example, in Serbia that the lithium price has, or excuse me, the Rio Tinto's big lithium mine has been closed permanently, well, obviously that's a really significant challenge, because the reality is nobody wants a lithium mine in their backyard. And lithium prices are up in an exceptionally dynamic manner over the course of the last 2 years. And demand for electric vehicles and batteries and renewable energy infrastructure continues. And when we think about the 700 billion that's out there looking for a home in the private equity sector in real assets, well, then some of them will be looking at the renewable energy sector. And this represents a new bull market. And it's obviously something that has the potential to animate the imaginations of investors. So, as we look at a corrective phase, we also should remember there's always a bull market in something. And what we may in fact be looking at here is the push factor. We've had the pull of valuations. Many of the emerging markets are trading at really quite attractive valuations. And their stock markets have been steadying over the course of the last few years. And their currencies have been steadying over the last few years. And people haven't really been paying attention to this relative strength because they haven't had to. There's been much more interesting things like cryptocurrencies and NFTs and big tech growth companies and the wonderful future of that's going to be created with no concern for profitability. But now that we're seeing underperformance coming through on Wall Street and more people looking at a discount rate and thinking about where a return can come from and how to capture a yield, well, then emerging markets are starting to become more interesting. So, valuations have been the pull factor, and underperformance in what people own is the push factor. And I always remind myself of just how much assets can rise when we are in a new commodity-led bull market. Because it was Brazil was the best performing asset between 2002 and 2008. It went up nearly 1800%. And that's for a country index. But the currency doubled in value. So there's the big linchpin. If we have underperformance on Wall Street, that's certainly a push factor. But the thing that really moves the needle in terms of emerging markets is the dollar. Now, the dollar index was up yesterday and down today, and it's still holding below that range between November and December, but it hasn't broken down yet. Of course, one of the reasons why the dollar has been firm has been because of the USA's growth, and it's been because of the strength of asset prices and Wall Street, but also it's been because investors were pricing in the potential that there would be a big interest rate differential between Europe and the USA. But if the Federal Reserve can't raise rates or can only raise rates very modestly, well, then that's going to start removing some of the support for the dollar. If growth moderates, that's obviously going to have an additional knock-on effect. So if the dollar starts trending downwards, then that's going to be the green light for investing in emerging markets and commodities. And I think that it's the Bloomberg Dollar Index is the more relevant one here because it has more emerging markets in it. So we're certainly in an interesting environment because we're potentially on the cusp of a very significant secular migration away from the go-go years of technology growth in an unparalleled fashion and back into real assets and a commodity-led bull market to really feed the demand for an energy transition and decarbonization and or at least a partial solution, or at least an effort to provide a solution to the fear of climate change. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.